This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 16th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm very pleased to have with me today Greg Hoglund. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how you doing?
Greg is a serial security entrepreneur who founded Sensic, BugScan, and HB Gary, where he currently works. Greg is well known in black hat circles for his outstanding work in exploiting bugs and reverse engineering. He's also a prolific author with three best-selling books under his belt, Exploiting Software, Rootkits, and his new book, Exploiting Online Games. I'm proud to have worked with Greg on Exploiting Software and Exploiting Online Games. Greg is also a budding pirate with an affinity for rum and a boat in constant need of repairs. So without further ado, let's get going. I first met you about a decade ago when you were working at Tripwire. How has your approach to computer security evolved over the last decade, you think?
Wow, that's a big question. I think I've become a non-believer. I guess I could say that at the beginning of my career, I had high hopes for security, and at this point in my career, I realize every single thing out there can be broken. Now, breaking things like games, that's a lot of fun. I really enjoy that the most because I like having a leg up over my competition in an unfair manner. I guess that's my pirate talking there.
Arr. You're supposed to say arr when you say that. So you've always been a proponent of deep technical discussion about exploits, probably because you're so good at it. Why do you think discussing exploits is important?
Well, certainly because discussing exploitation technology reveals the underlying weaknesses that the software has. And a lot of these are natural tendencies in software. Earlier in my career, I tended to focus more on schematic patterns in code as a way to find vulnerabilities. But I think I've kind of evolved to come to understand that there's actually underlying natural tendencies in software. And you really do have to explore the relative exploits that come out of that tendency to really understand the tendency itself.
So I'm not ready to
really give a treatise on this yet. This is some sort of new thinking that I've arrived at. But for example, C code, code written in C and C++, has a natural tendency to produce buffer overflows.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that that insight that you've developed will bode well or poorly for, say, the future of the static analysis market? I know you did BugScan early on, which was basically a static analysis tool for binary.
Static analysis is something that will always be required, but the terms that people use to describe different things in the reverse engineering industry, I think, are slightly outdated now. For example, even if you're using debugging technology in other ways other than static analysis, it might still be appropriate to say the words static analysis when you do finally dive into some disassembly code and convert it back into perhaps a higher level language pseudocode representation so that you can understand it.
Right.
There's always a case where you're usually going to need to read some disassembly, but I have lately been working very hard on, I guess, developing methods that don't require you to read disassembly that still allow you to arrive at or answer a reverse engineering question, a problem that you're trying to solve.
Right, so it's sort of a code understanding approach,
right,
or something like
well,
that.
Software understanding, what is it doing? And a lot of the questions, when they're not treated academically, but they're really, you know, your job, are very, very straightforward. For example, you may be tasked with developing a 32-byte unique signature for a NIDS appliance to capture a particular piece of malware, or perhaps capture the command and control channel that the malware may, a botnet or something, may be using. Now, that's a very real-world problem. You have a very limited amount of time. You have a limited budget. Your team is small. You're overloaded. You've got backlogs. You don't have a lot of time to sit there and convert an entire malware binary back to source code. It's very expensive to do that using static analysis. But there's dynamic methods that can reveal enough information in a rapid manner to get you to the place where you can develop that NIDS signature. So there's one example of where when you apply a real-world problem, sometimes static analysis isn't necessary, Or if it is necessary, the amount of work that statically needs to be performed may be very limited in scope.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that's one of the most expensive parts of the reverse engineering process.
Well,
so
you know that
the amount of time you have to do that is very important.
That may be a reflection of kind of the attacker's stance. That is, if all you have to do is figure out how to break something, then it might be slightly easier to use pieces and parts of some static analysis techniques to get in there and do what needs doing.
Whereas you're
doing offense, it might require a slightly more systematic approach to the whole shebang.
Yeah, that does make sense. If you already know what you're looking for, you want to take the shortest path to get there. Clearly, that's the attacker's stance. The defender has obviously a much harder problem because they have to think of every vector the attacker is going to try, and that's a very, very hard problem, very expensive.
So what do you think about people who say that talking about exploits and talking about the technologies and techniques that people use to do this is too dangerous? Do you think that they're just nuts?
Well, this is obviously a very old debate. And I'm definitely on the side where disclosure is good.
Yeah, I haven't met anybody yet who's on the other side, at least in the Silver Bullet series. Do you know?
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, you know, it's just because it's the right idea. If you keep things secret, it doesn't mean that no one's using them. It just means that the rest of us out here who don't have any idea about the technique are clueless, and we don't know what to do and how to defend ourselves. So
right.
It's always a good idea to discuss it. You know, there's always the argument that it causes some amount of pain, but I think believe that's a short-term pain. Maybe someone takes advantage of the information, but the fact is that that time window in which they can probably use that is limited in scope because the defenders are aware of the technique and they're trying to mitigate the risk.
So you've been very active in both disassembly, which you discussed briefly a minute ago, and also rootkit development. And I wondered what you think is the ultimate malicious hacker weapon. Is it the disassembler, or is it the rootkit, or is it something else?
Well, by far the most deadly weapon is a zero-day exploit.
Mm-hmm.
Those exploits are very difficult to develop, especially with the amount of effort that companies like Microsoft have placed into hardening their software and their operating system. Of course, that effort has made it more expensive and harder to develop and find exploits, but it certainly has not eliminated them. The ability to have a reliable remote exploit on a system is by far the most dangerous weapon. But that is, in and of itself, not a complete weapon. It needs to have a payload. And I think it's pretty obvious that payloads have evolved to basically be standalone rootkit material. The payload may live in the user mode section of the operating system, Ring 3, or it may live in the kernel. It doesn't really matter. The point is that there is this backdoor. The backdoor can do things as interesting is screen scraping, copying text out of dialog boxes, and a good application of that would be grabbing unencrypted text before it's been PGP encrypted,
mm-hmm.
Or vice versa after a decryption. There's all kinds of other capabilities like, you know, keystroke logging, etc. You can even turn a microphone on a laptop, let's say, and actually have a remote audio bug.
Yeah, we did that. We did that before during a TAB meeting once. Penny may have told you about that.
Well, yeah, so this is actually a very dangerous threat. A lot of malware is sort of an automaton, such as a botnet, let's say, that's not specifically targeted, and it may or may not find something of use if it's being driven by quote-unquote bad guys who haven't specifically targeted you. Then maybe it's just looking for things like Visa card numbers or something.
Right.
But the real problem comes into industrial espionage, or all forms of espionage, really, where the attacker actually specifically targeted you with intent. They know what they're looking for, and their backdoor system is designed specifically to help them gain that. Now you're talking about potentially millions or even hundreds of millions of damages if they get what they're going for. I think corporations now have something like 70% of their intellectual assets are stored digitally.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot.
Yeah, so it's a big target.
So, yeah, data theft is a huge emerging problem, and
so
people are starting to realize it.
Do you think that the bad guys know more about the ins and outs of, say, low-level attacks and how computers really work than the good guys know?
I think it would be, I don't know if I could say more, but it certainly would be a mischaracterization of the quote-unquote bad guys to say they do not have the same skill sets, same capabilities. They spend money to have this equipment built for them. a lot of the best rootkit technology has come not out of the United States, but out of the Eastern former Soviet Union, countries in Asia. These areas have younger guys or gals who probably will work for money, not that much money by U.S. market standards, and are able to develop rootkit technology that's easily on the cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say it's probably safe, it's a safe assumption that the bad guys are using very advanced rootkit material.
All right, so have we made any progress in rootkit defense, or has more progress been made in rootkit development?
It's an arms race, as always.
Yeah.
Vista has done amazing things to help prevent rootkits being introduced, but I'll throw something out there as kind of a funny thing that I did. I recently obtained a signing certificate. I can sign any driver I want to in 64-bit and load it up into the Vista kernel.
You're not supposed to do that.
I came out of a country in Belize, and I was able to obtain the certificate for about $200.
That's hilarious.
So it's absolutely easy for me to get a rootkit into the Vista kernel. If I can do it, and I had that idea, everybody else has already thought of it,
right,
too.
Right, right. Well, speaking of rootkits, during the Sony rootkit dust-up, you came out in favor of the use of rootkits by good guys. Do you stand by that position?
Absolutely. There is an important distinction, though, I think that needs to be made here. Rootkit is a term used to associate with malware. So what I have done is I don't call them rootkits. If you're using kernel-level technology for whatever reason to increase the security of your computers in your enterprise, that's not a bad thing. The thing that's important is that that technology remains entirely under your control as the administrator. And that's the key difference. A rootkit's used by bad guys to do bad things. An administrator using covert technology to monitor insider threats is an application of active forensics. It's a forensics investigation ongoing. And this is a new emerging market, as it turns out. We're not the only company at HP Gary who's peddling this kind of technology. There's several competitors in the space as well. And we're talking about the ability to hide undetected in a system and monitor it over time and collect evidence that can be used in the court of law during a court case. This information and the acquisition of it, maybe using a covert system sounds overkill, and probably is in many cases, but there will be situations where the person being monitored has security skills, or they have hacking skills, or even maybe are under the influence of an outside controller who is giving them tools that they can execute that reveal whether or not they're currently being monitored.
Right.
And in that case, you do need to take an extracurricular step in ensuring your investigation is not compromised because you're using a tool that's not hidden.
So that's more like spycraft, really.
It's really about insider threat monitoring.
So where do you draw the line then? If you know, things like the Warden that Blizzard Entertainment puts into World of Warcraft tick you off, and yet there are some good uses for these tools, where do you draw the line? How do you figure out how to draw the line?
Well, that's a new and upcoming area for the legal system, for sure.
Uh-huh.
The fact is that when you accept the EULA, apparently you accept everything that it does. The EULAs appear to be upheld in court many times. So, you know, if you've said you can scan my memory, then I'm sorry. You know, you may not like it, but they can do that.
Right, right. So as long as somebody clicks OK, it's all right.
It seems to be that's the trend right now. Obviously, some of the EULAs are absolutely ridiculous, and if they ever came to a court, I can't imagine how they could be upheld.
Yeah, well, my favorite one is the virus that we wrote about in, I think it was Chapter 4 of the new book, that comes along with its own EULA, and it says, "Hi, I'm a virus. I'm about to run. I'm going to send a copy of myself to everybody in your contacts. Click OK to agree." If people click OK, does that make it malware, or does that make it legalware?
Yeah, well, I would like to know. That's a very good question. I'm not sure anybody really knows yet.
I don't think they do either. We're in interesting times. So in the last couple of years, you've become very active in online game security. In fact, our new book, Exploiting Online Games, is coming out today. So what got you interested in game exploits?
Well, I don't play video games very well. I, even when I have cheats, still end up at the bottom of the score list. And you know, and I'm getting older. I'm in my 30s, and there's these 15-year-old kids. I got an Xbox 360 now, and they have the VPN. You could talk to people VOIP. Uh-huh. Boy, you know, I get my ass wiped all over the map. to put it, you know, succinctly.
So you were tired of losing, basically.
I got tired of losing. Yeah. You know, and especially if you're sitting there and you have a six-pack of beer to drink with your gaming experience, now when you have an aimbot and you can hit people from across the map in between the eyes with a sniper rifle, it gets a lot of fun.
So tell us about the kinds of money that game hackers and others can make through cheating.
Well, there's a huge market, as it turns out, in online virtual property. A very good example of this is World of Warcraft. There are thousands and thousands and thousands of accounts active any given time out of these shops in China or Southeast Asia. These shops, what they do is they employ fellas, they hire them in. It's a good job if you can get it in that particular economic region. I'm thinking they make about $4 a day, so they're not making a lot of money, but for them, that's a lot of money. By our standards, it doesn't sound like a lot, but think about it, this is a different economy there, so that's actually a good deal for them.
And there's a delta between the amount of virtual cash you could make, which has a real exchange rate in the real world.
Absolutely.
And that
so
salary.
I think, you know, a guy working in there for $4 an hour is running probably 10 different bots at once, and these are all botting. They don't play manually. They have a bunch of computers around them, and they're generating, you know, 300 or 400 gold pieces an hour using level 60 or above accounts, farming in specific regions of the game. The amount of income that a given shop over there could easily exceed $30,000 a month in transactions. And that's at wholesale rates, by the way. That's selling gold for, I think, about 4 cents on the gold piece, whereas the retail rates go out for 10 cents a gold piece or more on sites like, I think it's called IGE.com, and they sell a lot of gold.
So
there.
How widespread do you think that cheating is like that?
Oh, it's huge. What's really interesting about World of Warcraft, I don't like to pick on them a lot, they've recently had these mass bannings, and their entire shop will be based on one botting technology, and for some reason it leaks or somebody gets a hold of it or they know more about it, or it's based on something public, which is very common.
Mm-hmm.
There's something called ISX WoW that recently was Warden banned, and thousands of these guys got banned in one day, and you know their entire business is based on whether or not the bot is operating and can remain stealth. In one banning, they lose their entire business. Boom. Just like that. Now that's a lot of risk for a company to be at. So people who are out in the botting business, people who use some of the techniques that we describe in our book, but they sell these bots professionally, are actually going to have quite a nice little small business on their hands providing this technology, because the rest of the guys out there farming with the technology are absolutely dependent upon the stealth capability of the bot. They could lose their entire revenue stream in one banning.
So there's a sort of a tricky economic issue involved with that too, which is that when, say, Blizzard decides to ban a bunch of people and they ban, say, 1,000 characters from the game, they lose revenue from those 1,000 characters as
well. Actually, as it turns out, they don't.
Aha, uh-huh, why is that?
Those Coast guys go right out and buy all new accounts again. In fact,
oh, so it's
I have
a good
it on
way,
the download.
It's good for
basically,
the
Blizzard in their boardroom can sit there and say, all right, we need an injection of revenue next month. Do a banning. Because every time they do that, there's a spike in sales.
Oh, that's hilarious. I
have
no idea.
So it's actually something they can play with financially.
So do you think that the book Exploiting Online Games is going to make things worse?
No, it won't make things worse at all. The people who are out there writing the bots and doing the stuff have been doing it well before this book came out. Many of the techniques that we reveal are not techniques that we made. They're what we learned from the rest of the guys out there. So this stuff's going on with or without Greg and Gary's help. All we're doing is exposing it to the rest of the planet so they can all understand. This is an exciting new time. This is a whole new space. Game hacking was never connected to money before.
Right, now it is.
This is a whole new world.
So what are the technical issues involving time and state that lead to these rampant security problems in games like World of Warcraft teach us about other kinds of software?
Well, you just hit on that. The time and state issues are by far the most interesting. You know, automating a program to simply drive your character around and have it kill things and grab gold isn't so much of an exploit as it's just simply breaking the EULA. The exploits are different. The exploits are where you trade 100 gold pieces to your buddy, and then he runs into a building that makes him change servers, and you disconnect, And then he logs in, and he's standing back out on the steps for some reason, and he has 200 gold instead of 100. Because the database is desynchronized and didn't catch back up again, and you duplicated the item.
So all of a sudden, you're minting money.
You're minting virtual money, and it's unbelievable. The value of one duplication exploit is probably worth over $100,000 if it's used properly. That is, if it's in the right game, it's a game that has a market, but the duplication is exponential. 200, 400, 800, you figure it out. You're going to have the hardest time just laundering the money.
So I recall the friend of yours who did a dupe bug in Star Wars Galaxies. You might talk about that.
Yeah, he wasn't a friend of mine. I just read about him. But he made, and you had a dupe bug for the in-game currency in Star Wars Galaxies. I believe the underground scuttlebutt was he even got IGE.com, the company that sells gold, to make hundreds of accounts or something to help him launder the money.
Mm-hmm.
So even though companies like IGE say they don't sponsor, you know, cheating, they're lying. They do. That entire business is based on stuff like that.
Right.
So he had all this assistance, him and I guess two other guys. And they made millions in a course of like 4 months. And I guess he kept about 700,000 of that money for himself. I believe he lives in Canada. He bought a home with that money, and in tribute to how he got it, the doorbell plays the Star Wars Imperial March.
As it should be. So the last question, which is slightly off topic, but what is your daughter, who's now 11, right?
I believe so, yes. Yeah, 11.
Learned about exploiting software.
She has learned that when her girlfriend steals the white bunny fluffy something or another on Neopets, that she can make an exact copy of the HTML code, which is the login screen for Neopets, and fool her friend into logging into that by pasting a URL to her in Instant Messenger, and then have that password get logged, what was typed into that form, to a text file. And she can get back.
Did she make you write the code to do that, or did she do that herself?
She had the idea, but I had to write the little back-end PHP thing that saved the thing to the text file. She didn't know how to program, but
that's
she certainly
hilarious.
She was hacking. She was definitely in the mode of hacking at that point.
And what has she done to exploit these skills that she's developed?
Well, that was one. But I think that's about the most hard example. Other things she's done is she's learned to type gobbledygook into the forms, like single tick characters and stuff, in order to induce errors, like database errors. And I had a game with her. Actually, this was back when she was like 7 years old, where if she could get it to give like a database error, she got a prize. You know, I'd buy her ice cream or something. So there was actually a reward for her to find those. But that was just button mashing.
So she's like a penetration tester using a fuzzer.
Yeah, and she's probably about just as effective as most of the commercial solutions out there.
Well, I'd have to agree with that. Thanks, Greg. It's been fun.
No problem.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, where excerpts are published in every issue. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.